Dr. Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about...
Hello, David Cohen. This is a podcast while driving. Just driving a very short distance up to the next village in the Blue Mountains. Very sunny day. And the story is that sort of getting my brain track. There's a bit of a story behind that. So the other listeners probably will know about it. And it just means that I have to sort of mix talking and other activities to get things just running smoothly. Now, I'm doing this because I've corresponded with you a little bit about chasing the sun, and I've got a few thoughts about it, and I've sort of got an obligation, as you've said, that you're going to come up with the next edition, fix up a few mistakes and stuff like that, which is perfectly normal. That's basically what I do, but I don't do anything to get it published or anything like that. I just decide, oh, I'm going to have a go at this, and then, the mistakes are the great thing, which I sort of mull through. Some of them are things I can fix, other things are just some missettings of society and stuff like that. So I should talk initially about, before I get into the mistakes, I'll just look at the ecosystem of where people act. So there's a vast majority of the, I suppose, naive public. Then you have some university academics, which are institution-bound. So they're limited in what they can say and what they can do and how much they... They've got all these limitations in order to optimise that they do their particular job of teaching or researching or maintaining or something like that. And they have this sort of a quality assurance system with them, and so when they write things, they have to research them thoroughly and get that correct. And so to get it correct, they narrow down. And then to get the turnover, they have to go from ultra-narrow field to the next narrow field and actually progress our knowledge through a scientific method, basically, of induction developed by Francis Bacon. I'm just giving you this basic story where you have a guess, a hypothesis, and then you see if there's any exceptions to the hypothesis, and eventually that hypothesis comes in within the boundary. So that process is a very narrow process. So a lot of our knowledge and culture is locked up in this area, and also locked up in cultural ceremonies. And then this process is very selective about who they take, and there's a lot of people left on the sidelines, and it's these people that you read, and they get some really interesting books. You're not in that category. They're called, we've got the Society of Independent Scholars in Australia. You read a few books, and they are absolutely fantastic. They're well-researched, on topic, in the theme, combining all history and everything together. Something someone who's new to a field can really pick up and pick things up. And these are warmly written. There's personality, all these things which scholars at universities don't do, because that's not their job. Their knowledge is internal to the knowledge structure. These are fresh people coming along, and indeed, these people tend to be female authors, and they're on topics, and you can really go. Sometimes the information is bad. Sometimes it's good. It's sort of wristwatch wherever you get. So these people are often in libraries, in a book, a section that their book's there. Sometimes, as we've known, like your story of the Arabic research into the history of Arabic astronomy, was they're in refuse bookshops, and that people in this refuse book thing, people pick them up for a dollar, and although they've lost commercial value, they've got they can rebirth like this. And indeed, your book, Chasing the Sun, is was a specialist bookshop, which in Australia carries lines of books which won't sell in the mainstream. And people go to these bookshops, these particular bookshops, to pick things up because they know that this sort of thing will interest people who just don't fit into the category. So they're sort of misfits for misfits area coming across. Now, yourself is a different style of academic in terms of that you go out and you engage and you build and you structure and you let the information build the story. And your book was actually quite brilliant. It starts off with a sunrise and sunset without, and there would be a temptation of me like an author to say, well, look, we're going to hit you over the head, we're going to go here, and all these aspects of the book come through, and a lot of things as you read, you say, oh, I do like that, because you let the narrative of your discovery direct the narrative of your inspection, and often the story is not in the actual structure of the knowledge, but it's in the structure of your engagement in it. So there was the chapter about going through the operas and visiting this woman, and people have the ability to pick up a character, store the character, and you sort of say, oh, what happened to that woman? I'm obviously, unfortunately, autistic enough. When you said, you know what she happened, I assume she went home to die in Chile. But I sort of like the loose ends on that. So overall, a brilliant aspect of it. And there is a parallel between trying to get out there, where you have to just get out and experience, immerse, and do things like that. And I do that in terms of, I send emails, they don't necessarily work. I do other things like this podcasting. We're up to the shops now to go and talk about. And having the experience of what I'm doing, I feel that I'm a human spam in terms of that my emails get treated as spam, and my actual visiting people, they don't necessarily work. And spam, if you're going to be spam, you know that you're spam, and you don't offend people being spam. Oh, she was. There's a good old friend of mine. Okay, I'm here. I'll have to start this up in a short time coming back. Thanks a lot for listening. 7 minutes gone. Hello, Dave. It's Richard. I knew someone called David Cohen. It's Richard Cohen. I hope I didn't call you David before. And with this is, whole thing, I've got to be absolutely sure on. So this, you just have to get used to this. This is the podcast that you do, slipping in between things. So I'm actually not going home. I'm actually just whooping around the corner to my mate to drop in on him, just to see how he is. You know, to support that type of stuff. I call it support. I actually just want to find out a few things from him. You are a special type of academic. I think I call you an academic, a knowledge enthusiast. Really, as far as I can see, a class of your own. However, you do bring your own expertise to it all, and this is the publishing side. And so you've been able to pick up what publishing, sort of a publication view of the world. Now, there's a few things I can actually add to that now that I know that you're in that framework. I did notice that your story about the Manhattan Project, where they weren't serious until the Germans stopped publishing. And indeed, look, it's not that one thing's right or the wrong. There's a million aspects of the truth seen from different directions. There's no individual truth. So this is the Manhattan Project at the start of World War II. Now, there's some publication story, which I will tell you down the track. So what it will be is some of the, putting you right on the science, some of the things which I'm not expert on and found out not to be true. Majority of things have been found out to be stunningly true. I would not have thought. You know, you wouldn't have thought. Now, it's very interesting that that people unaware of this, and it's not due to the fact that the information's not out there. It's sort of socialising ignorance. So finding out about the Islamic, the origin of Islamic calendars, I sort of researched a little bit more to find out about the black rock, the black stone, and other aspects of it and its structure. But I'm coming to the view that a lot of people, there's a sort of a acceptable mean of ignorance. That is, it's acceptable to be ignorant. And if anyone asks questions about it, and you're not, there's certain processes which they dismiss you, i.e. that you're not a Richard Cohen going around the place. No one cares what you say anyway. I don't know. There's all these sort of things I'm just trying to say, so you come across this information. So I'm going to do a few things where I've researched and I said, no, this is actually not what the case is. So science, not what the case is, and then some publication story. How about that to wrap things up? And this is the view that you're going to do a re-edit of it. And really, I'm sort of in the same boat as you, except I go around, find the information percolates through me, and I improve it bit by bit, like this tiny sun story. And there's a sort of not so tiny sun in Australia with the actual planets mapped out. So this is sort of a rather interesting overall story. I'm nearly at this mate's place. Look, the important thing to say is that there's well, it's really fundamental that the speed, you say that the speed of light can slow down and even stop. Now, there's lots of things to say about that. That's not true. Okay, so that's a fundamental thing you have in the book, which is not correct. There's a few fundamental science things which are not correct. So the speed of light is defined constant. Right? It is defined constant. In a series of postulates by Einstein, and light in the universe is basically what makes space space, different from a void that you can imagine. So empty space has the property that it can propagate light by Maxwell's law. It's got, so as your phone or mechanical device has it's got two aspects of it, capacitance and inductance. There is a capacitance and inductance of nothing. And that capacitance and inductance of nothing leads up to the speed of light. Now, as it comes across, as you study it, and you just have to trust me, firstly, the speed of light is definitely constant. However, there are two speeds of light. Okay, just get your mind around it. There's the phase velocity, which is that if you sit on a crest of a piece of light, so there's two velocities, right? Okay, and so we're both right and wrong. There's phase velocity, which is defined to be the speed of light, and it's constant for all frames of references. And then there's something else that's called the group velocity, which is if I have a pulse of light, the waves of light are going through that pulse all the time, but the pulse itself is actually, if it's not going at the speed of light, is actually walking backwards. So you get group velocity. So you've got these two things that you have, phase velocity, and that's defined, and group velocity. So, look, there you have it. There's two speeds of light. There are two forms of a wave. One is the carrier wave and the signal. And so the signal, just having a check out here. Okay. Don't know whether my friend's in here. We'll be back in a short while. So, I think they're off to visit. Okay. See you in a short while, mate. Okay. Richard, I've just finished visiting that friend. We had a good old laugh for a while. It's always good to go around and have a mutual morale boost. Okay, so it is fundamental that the speed of light is the same in all situations, and there's special relativity and general relativity. But in the essence, those two theories of Einstein contain a Well, they're written in reference to the actual conceptual frame of reference, which is the classical frame of reference. So, now, what happens is that light is at the same time, the speed, but it can appear to speed, slow down as it falls into a black hole. And the way it does slow down, well, it doesn't actually slow down, the actual time slows down as you go into a black hole. So time itself can also vary. So indeed, the time on the surface of the sun is going a little bit slower than the rest of the universe. So there's that factor to do with general relativity, light and speed. Now, in Star Wars, you have the idea of being able to see a travelling pulse. Now, obviously, there's, you know, like so many reasons that you wouldn't be able to see that in space. One is that there's no particles in space to scale it on that. It's just complete fiction. However, you can have a pulse which travels more slowly. Even though its phase velocity is instant, its group velocity is slow. So, if I put held an optical fibre direct between here and New York, it would take, I forgot what the refractive index of glass one part of, so if it took, you know, 2 milliseconds for the light to travel in free space, it would take 3 milliseconds to travel through the optical fibre. Because what's actually happening is the glass is absorbing the light. You know, the light gets absorbed and re-radiated a short while afterwards. And so it's sort of like Michael Jackson's moonwalking. Now, this is just another thing to just freak your mind out. Again, Einstein and Hinduism actually goes together in terms of that the idea of a frame of reference is the there's sort of a democracy written in Einstein. This is all true. A frame of reference is referred to a person owns a frame of reference, or you conceive of a person owning a frame of reference. And the frame of reference, if you like, is just between your eyes and behind, just beneath your eyes. And that means that's your now. And you are always at the greatest length of time from the start of the universe. In fact, everyone is equally like that. And your feet are 3 nanoseconds. Or she was... I'm just trying to think of it. Nanoseconds. A foot a nanosecond. So you've... Say 5 nanoseconds in the past from your head. Or 4 nanoseconds in the past. And in fact, this phenomenal thing happens in that if you have a watch and you hold the watch very close to your face and you move it away from your face, the act of moving it away, the clock will slow down a little bit and it will go into the part, it will fall behind by a certain amount. As it's redshift, the ticks will go longer as it's travelling away from you. I guess that's the ticks, and it will be three nanoseconds slow. So nanoseconds is a billionth of a second. And as you bring it towards you, it will blue shift, speed up a bit, and be in time. So you can actually physically see your wrist is in the past. Now this does sounds that's palaver. As we in Australia say, it's a load of palaver. That's just the car. I'm going to take a risk there. Okay. So, there's all that thing about group velocity and phase velocity. And so the speed of light, this group velocity speed does slow down in an optical fibre. It does slow down in a crystal, a device, a resonant structure. And it's simply because it's like they've got someone who's just hell-bent on running, you want to slow them down. So what you say is, I want you to run halfway to complete the race, then run back to the start line, and then run 2/3 of the way, then run back to the start line, and you have this sequence that they're running, they're reflecting backwards, and you can actually store the light by getting it to run backwards. Yeah, so you can store the light between two mirrors, or you can actually store the oscillation of the light in basically an atom, which is acting a bit like a mirror, and it stores and almost captures the light. So if it's on resonance, it will actually get absorbed. If it's near absorption, the atom will go, yeah, I want to absorb you. Nah. And it's sort of like you're trying to sell something, and you're trying to sell it, and the atom nearly buys it, but then it gives it away to you. So you've still got your light, but it's been slowed down. Now, just almost home here. So we've done the speed of light aspect of it. And so, this sort of says to me that you just need, basically, physicists to speak to you. Now, the other thing is that the physicists who are good at communications, the physicists which greet you when you go into the university, have got all the education grants, they're the people who, when they hear the real explanation and they don't understand it, they start to attack you. No, they're very friendly to you, but they're very aggressive to people like me. Now, I'm afraid it's like that. And first you go, well, what's going on here? And you get affronted. Now I just laugh at it. And look, I can guarantee everything I'm saying about the speed of light being constant. So the speed of light has been constant, and we believe it's been constant throughout all time. Now, here's something else that we have the speed of light. The universe is at a certain distance away, the speed of light plus the elastic expansion. Now, I'm going to have to go back and talk a bit more. I'll have a chat about Herschel. All right, see you in a moment, Brett, mate. Okay, I'm recording again, David Cohen. So what's happened is I've had down at the shops, prepare stuff for lunch. Unfortunately, after that, I fell asleep, and now I'm looking after kids at home, so I have to actually get my exercise on an exercise bike, so you'll hear it, and I'll just go along. So this is unusual. I'm pretty amazed from reading your book that there's all these unusual people that you speak with, and it's perhaps unusual listening to people doing all these different things. So my small little podcast audience is used to me driving, walking, and most recently exercise biking, as the weather's cold outside and I have to be at home and look after kids. And so the general theme is that we were talking about your book and how it's amazingly correct and amazingly complex and well-structured and all these brilliant things. And there's a few points to do with the physics. I'd say about 5% are questionable. But within that questionable stuff, I review some of them, and indeed they're open to interpretation. I learn new things, so it's a pretty good rank. And slightly different... like there's a weakness in some of these ideas, but there's also a strength in the way that they're gathered, and the way of sort of researching, reading all the literature that go into all the different people and making it quite interesting. You're populated with people, and the actual people can allow... this will go, so I'll be cycling for a fair while. Here, so I hope I don't drop off my perch. So we're discussing the speed of light, and indeed there are two speeds of light. There's Einstein's speed of light, the phase velocity, and you've got the group velocity, which determines a pulse in a medium. So a pulse in a medium in an optical fibre
travels 50 points slower. The refractive index is the of a medium. So a medium is just something for which you can write a wave equation, a way it propagates in it. So refractive index takes three times as long. So if a water's got, I think, 1.33, so basically if you have your distance a light minute away, the light travelling through water will arrive at your destination at a minute and 33 seconds. Or if it's diamond, a light minute of diamond, which is a fair amount of light because it goes 1 second to go, or 60 times further than the moon, it's there. Now, it's the sun's 8 light minutes away, which is important to understand the surface of the sun. So there's that aspect of it, and you know, it's one of those things to really get in. I want to stop off and say that you get to really know some scientists, which I hadn't known before. I hadn't known that Herschel had written science fiction. And this gets into the heart of it. This is science fantasy as opposed to science fiction. I begin to understand the difference between it, and that Herschel believed that the sun could be cool inside, and there could be people living inside the sun. And as we see the sun as a fiery surface, they would see the entire heavens as burning hot. And this is dismissed, but then if you know cosmology, this is indeed what's happened with the universe. The universe is very hot, but it's expanded on the inside and cooled in. And so we indeed see to the surface of the original sun, which is the cosmic microwave background. But we have cooled down by expanding. So it's Herschel's insight into what is the sun. It's actually an insight into what we're at. And with all these things, there's sort of popular science. But one of the things I do think you tend to encounter is that, say, if you walk into a place, you will tend to pick up the people who confidently explain things but don't necessarily understand it. I don't know, that may be a bit unfair. But that's what I found, that the people who position themselves in education very much spruik what their knowledge is, but don't stop and reflect. Now, before I go, you know, I want to cover a little bit of quantum mechanics, so there's a bit of solar physics to go inside of that. Yes, so many different things. What I'd like to do is an example of something which I thought was a mistake, and then sort of come back at it. Now, I'm very interested in science fiction as a influencer of science. So you can be a scientist and have a very high, narrow view about science, and this is particularly if you're in an institution and you want to maintain credibility and respect. You don't start off talking about weird ideas and stuff like that. And so if you consider that one string of the science instrument, there are other strings that vibrate. One is science fiction, and I suppose another is your type of inquiry. They both resonate in society and throw up ideas for us to look at, and there are barriers between it all. So very interested in science fiction and poetry and original ideas. So science fiction and philosophy sort of move together. And I was, I suppose, interested in what was, I would consider the first science fiction. And I put it down on Francis Bacon's New Atlantis, because it's a very, very important, because that's the basis of the Royal Society and the American Constitution. And there are a few stories I want to cover on the publishing front, because I found, again, the influence of books and publishing very important. And there's some key scientists for you to know about. So Francis Bacon, in his last years of life, wrote this science fantasy about a person coming to this land, and it's essentially occupied by scientists, and they research things. Now, was it Jonathan Swift wrote a parody of it in Gulliver's Travels? And now, as I come across them, I realise that that's something I will have to read a bit more about Gulliver's Travels. And so you can see that it's got sort of some foundation aspect of it, but you found this Roman dude who wrote this early science fiction. And again, I suppose this is the difference between science fiction and science fantasy, trying to really get in on that. And some of the ideas contained in your descriptions are sort of pretty revolutionary. That if you could habit on these planets and what these things made. Now, one of the things, having rudimentary school Latin, I suppose, and a bit of Google Translate, you get into reading these Latin, original Latin translations, and I think it's, you often get sort of amazed. I think it's a famous book which was saved from ancient times called Letters to Leviticus. And really, when you read it, translate it, it's sort of like put out the cat, pay so-and-so. These letters are sort of pretty, sort of insanely boring. And then there's Livy. So if you actually read the translations, you go, hang on. So if you read Livy, a lot of it, when you actually read it, is, well, not, I dissected a cow, but you know, this sheep died here, this eagle landed over here, this happened. It was Livy who talked about ghosts and poltergeists, and just reading it along. Because what happens is, if you read the original stuff, you get the raw chatter, sort of like the CIA listening into it. But the interesting thing of reading your book was the idea of Winston Churchill. And of course, Winston Churchill has this sort of electric resonance in certain parts of Australia, partly because he was the architect behind Gallipoli, and so many Australians died at Gallipoli, and his interference caused a lot of Australian deaths over the period. Withdrawal of the Australians from Tobruk, the fall of Tobruk, but then they were diverted to garrison Ceylon or Sri Lanka, rather than come back, and so we had basic reserve units, sort of shopkeepers fighting against the Japanese, as all these things due to Winston Churchill. There's another amazing story of how Winston Churchill wanted a platypus for the war effort, and the platypuses are very frightened animals and German U-boats attacked the ship carrying the platypus, or it's in the area after it crossed the Panama Canal. And there's a huge amount of research necessary to keep platypus alive. So these are these little creatures, and the major thing is that they eat such a huge amount of food, like an unbelievable quantity of food, to keep themselves going. People just hadn't thought of it, and so the main thing to keep them alive is to feed them. But as the depth charge went off, the sound of the shot killed the platypus, and Winston Churchill, it turned out, they discovered, had a stuffed platypus on his desk for all this effort. And so, of course, Savile, I can't pronounce it properly, he wrote this book in 1899, and this was, according to you, as I read it, and of course, one of the things is I'm reading the books and going back to recall them to see whether my interpretations are correct. So it's pretty clear that Churchill was influenced by science fiction, and it turned out later that he had science fiction great ideas, like science fantasy, it might be more, in that he had the idea of aerial landmines and iceberg aircraft carrier. So I'm just breathing heavily here. I'm not looking at the time. Oh my god. Oh, crap. Sorry, I just have to do, gosh, really, unfortunately, to lose weight. I've got a window recovery time. I don't know how long the window is. I've got to get as recovered as humanly possible. So it just requires a lot of effort. So getting back to this Savile book, it sort of paints a bigger picture. So you can see from reading the book, I went and got the book and read it, hoping it to be what I consider science fiction, and it's, from reading it, you can see this man is a Victorian gentleman. He's someone raised when the British Empire was great, and he single-handedly has kept alive the spirit of the British Empire, while the rest of Britain has sort of disintegrated around him. And reading the book, you realise, oh, he's got a Victorian intellect and a Victorian social structure and empathy, the whole gamut of Victorian views, sort of reading it, so it was quite insightful to read it. And but generally, Savile had nothing to do with space, had nothing to do with leaving the planet, nothing to do with the sun, and nothing which would put it in my first definition of science fiction, which has to have an element of science in it. And then discussions with my kids said, oh, look, science fiction is so much more. It's got to have these elements of it. So it's got to have a problem presented to society. It's got to have people give up. You've got people for the problem, people giving up the problem, and people who can solve the problem, and society moves forward. And so science fiction doesn't necessarily have to have anything scientific about it. And so immediately put what I considered science fiction, which is called New Atlantis, on hold. And so the entire thing is all debatable, and it's this question. Now, the important thing is that in terms of science fantasy, Churchill was a Victorian person who believed in science, and science is a Victorian, scientist is a Victorian invention. The word was invented by Reverend Weewa, and related to Faraday, which we'll, I suppose, talk about straight after this. But Savola is basically a, you've got the despotic person, which could well be Hitler, eventually down the road. He's down the road, and you've got military terrorism, shooting civilians with dum-dum bullets, and this dystopic feeling of powerlessness as politics goes on. It's all that sort of the structure which goes into World War II. Now, rather than fighting it, he was into it, and you can see that he understood the structure of World War II, because he basically authored it. Yeah, I don't know. And going on, so you have the dictator's wife, who's now become strangely disinfected, and his real English cigar-smoking country club gentleman saying he was youthful womanly, or but she had developed into the fulsome woman of post-youth, and this and that creeps out, and you realise that he's actually describing his mother. She goes off, and essentially he's the powerful, so well, it's the powerful leader of the revolution by being able to basically describes Winston Churchill's future of life, and the people in order to get him start the navy, who's still loyal to the dictator, start shelling the city, and it really runs out of the city, and he uses a Victorian invention of this fictitious European Mediterranean state with a capital constitution, all the components together, which you can argue about. Now, really, that actually puts it back into, you know, it's not a starship, it is sort of like a starship of civilization, which explains that. So, it's, indeed, although it's his only novel, has some common elements to science fiction, and though it's, you know, mystic science fiction work, and he, besides science fiction, is able to speak the language of possibility, of fantasy, all that type of stuff, which is in science fiction. So you have, dare I say, people who can't do fantasy, can't do any high-level thinking whatsoever. Not that there's any bad about them. And therefore they've got no need for scientists or academics or universities. It's just build shopping centres and mine coal and that type of stuff. So there's, it's one of these things where it's debatable whether Winston Churchill wrote this is a work of science fiction. There's no science in it, but it's got the elements, some elements of science fiction, and it's got other literature elements. Now, in terms of literature, one of the, can I talk a bit about literature? It's a very interesting, you too, how you wrote about the invention of the Black Sun as a sort of a counter reinvention. Yeah, a counter reconstruction of dechristianized, Germanic pure religion, and Schopenhauer, and how Schopenhauer and all those people led into World War II, and there's a theory. Now, given that you've got so many academics, you're going to get so many theories, but this is actually quite a good theory, because I read the ring cycle before, or read of the ring cycle before this theory came out. So there's something about hearing a theory and then reading something. You know, it's sort of poisoned it the opposite way around. So one of the things is I want to research Schopenhauer, just read his works from end to end, and he seems a very addictive, reasonable person. We have to really get into him, unlike Nietzsche, who's a good commentator on Victorian thought, but, you know, off his noodle. Schopenhauer is someone to really get to understand. But essentially, the SS uniform is operatic. The campaigns are sort of quasi-operatic. The filming is operatic. The uniform, the SS uniform, is operatic. It was very interesting for you to say SS means Schwartz's son, and the idea of where the sun is brightest, we need a black sun to actually create some sort of dimensionality. So I can sort of see that. And then, of course, we had the Christchurch massacre, where the actual person believed in the black sun. And this is after reading your book. So I read your book, and then this came across. And so the consequence of that is that there's a key academic in Australian Parliament, and I'm going to ship your tattered book off to her to have a look at it. There's nothing wrong with that. But, and look, the odds are that nothing will happen with this. I'm just going to check my my heart rate here as I'm going along. That's going for a long time. Sorry for doing this. I'm cruising. I'm not really. You can see I'm not pushing myself whatsoever. That's excellent. It's going to go for a long time. Basically the ring cycle, you have these certain things. You've got Siegfried, who gets shot in the back and going out hunting, and just sort of, you know, the opera's a long opera and you lose concentration, and what's going on? It's sort of just life hunting in Nazi Germany, and he goes out hunting and gets shot in the back because his armour is useful to be really armoured, but he's not properly looked after, and it really doesn't correspond with what actually happened in World War II, but it happens in the German mythology of it, you know, to explain how the right wing view could not work. He provides an explanation, a conspiracy explanation, rather than analysis, saying that the Germans just didn't have enough fuel, so just couldn't do what they wanted to do, and there were a few dumb mistakes along the way. But all throughout the opera, you've got Wotan singing things you cannot understand. So he's picking up fireworms and he's planting them around Valhalla. And at the end, as Brunhilde goes into his funeral pyre, and the Rheingold melts and goes back into the Rhine. So Germany's gone through this, and we've gone through this mystic period. Look up in Valhalla, the time of the German mysticism burns, so, which is sort of similar, has been allied to the bunker burning. So you can see how the books of the opera go into history, and Savola is also an important thing which goes into the history. Now, there's a few publishing things which are really important. So, you probably know this already, of course. So, Benjamin Franklin. Now, I just have to say that what's happened, obviously, I've had these strokes and stuff like this. And so, this information is just pouring out of memory. I've got no way of checking it. I can't tell whether it's true or false. I can tell it's true. I know the aspects of it true, but I think he was one of 12 children, a poor son of working for a printing press, which would take expensive English books and print them, publish them. And the interesting aspect is that I think the young 11-year-old or 12, he taught himself to, I'm going to talk about Franklin first, by arranging the print in the printing press and putting it out. And he wrote this Mrs. Goodbody, something like this, this fictitious person who put another idea and got the response to it. And this is very interesting in that this idea of a predicted personality for which society organises, sort of like having a puppet out in front of you, which is essentially how politicians grew. But he learnt this really early on about Benjamin Franklin. And again, you've got the science fiction of New Atlantis coming in to structure the American Constitution. So they've all read this stuff, and indeed the charter for the American colonies, the English colonies, were based on this New Atlantis idea. So it's, in terms of literature, it's very intense. Franklin's credited with creating the concept of a library or a book exchange, pretty much similar to what I'm doing with your book. I'm reading it and passing it on to the next interested reader, sort of, which is sort of like the Napster or the, you know, the pirating which happens nowadays. Franklin is, you can understand Franklin in terms of dimensionality from his background in publishing. Another person very important in this entire science history, and I suppose eventually to the sun, is Faraday, Michael Faraday. Now, Michael Faraday's dad had an accident, and they had to move from Northern England to London, which is really like being in Sydney with a Kiwi accent. It's just, you know, not going to get anywhere. No, you will. Kiwis are loved here. I was trying to think. Oh, trying to make him with a South Australian accent in New South Wales or something like that. I can't quite describe it. And he was very poor and worked for a printer. And one of the things is he was printing the... he learnt to read literacy from actually printing books. And he printed various books explaining science to women. And so that explained his basic understanding of chemistry was on a strand of science, not for the other scientists, but to teach women. That's, I suppose, a little bit interesting. And he used to go to these public lectures by Davies, and he got his notes and published his notes in a book and gave the book to Davy. Then Davy blew his face off, and Lady Jane had married a rich person and a lord, and when the lord died, the title died. She's had all the money, but not the title. I mean, you know, what the heck's going on now? Oh yeah, I just have to get in my history. So Lady Jane then had to find someone and marry them who was going to become a lord so she could keep the title. Whatever you do, I'd, you know, pretty amazing. And so Davy was awarded, Humphrey Davy was awarded a medal by Napoleon. And of course, this is a political problem. Yeah, a British citizen awarded a medal by a foreign emperor. All this confusion going on. So they're going to knight him so that knowledge where he's it. And so Lady Jane said, oh, come along. And I'd sort of just say that. And they got married, and Davy thought, oh, this is a classic marriage misunderstanding. He thought it was free money. I can research as much as I want. And she thought, well, he can now become an English person, never research again. And he had blown his face off. And they said, well, here's this book of notes. Here's this Faraday person. And Faraday had got himself in a punch shop. And, look, there's so many book things I have to say to you. Faraday went to London on their honeymoon. So Humphrey organised a honeymoon thing, visiting Ampere and Mrs. Ampere. It's important that they aspect of him. And visit Mr. Amp and Mr. Volt. He visited both of them in this tour and was keen on discovering and naming elements, and he was the sort of the go-to person, sort of like the Richard Attenborough or Dawkins, sort of famous thing. But you still didn't make any money. It was certainly the time of gentlemen, landed gentlemen, doing sort of the idol natural philosopher. So getting on, and so bridal carriage came up, and here's my friend Faraday, who would have perhaps stunk and been a bit, I don't think he would have stunk, but he's an ample, really gentle person, and welcome. And then the next scene is that he's sitting on top of the carriage, going to, was it Calais to Paris, whatever they got off. And of course, it was the worst weather ever, and he was completely soaked and completely bedraggled. And this is Faraday, and there's a side story for it. So here's someone who decided to go science, because he was printing the Encyclopedia Britannica, the page on electricity. And it was electricity. What is it scientists have to do? And sort of the printing of the Encyclopedia Britannica was so vague that he said, I'll get into it. So he's there, and he said, well, that's the end of the journey. That's it. I'm pissed off. I'm giving up. Now, Lady Ampere bonded with him, not, you know, sexually or anything like that, understood of him being displaced from this group and took on the thing, and he turned him around and reshaped him. And the discussions with Ampere and Humphrey and Faraday led Faraday, who was an experimentalist, to build the first electric motor and then discover generators. And then within short shift, we had the modern age of electricity, which birthed into the start of the Victorian era. Now, it's interesting that Lady Ampere was intensely unhappy in the marriage. It's one of the things I've got to really understand. Oh, crap. Oh, sorry. Shouldn't do that. I've just got to keep on going. And I'm just, there is a point to it. And so, and now this again, it's only after lots and lots of reading. You can, if you read it first once, think it, the story makes a certain amount of sense, but then not. Certain amount of sense and then not. And it's only recently that that Lady Ampere was dislocated from her relationship. And that wasn't necessarily a bad thing in the big thing, because it opened things up to seeing other things. And I think there's a big story there. So, So, Faraday was a Northern Englander, sort of much loved. Oh, you know, here's a printing story. He was a preacher and used to write religious tracts, and he would do his own engravings with his wife. So he's always good with his wife. And just to give you a background, if someone said, look, I'd like to go out with you, he said, oh no, I'm doing something else. What else are you doing? Check the diary. And because people asked him, he would go into the poor parts of of London give alms. So it's really religious, and he did religious pictures showing the hand of God and the sun rays, the miracles coming down, and these etched lines. Now, how it so happened that when he was dealing magnetic fields, drawing magnetic fields, he would transfer that religious picture to magnetic field lines and electric field lines. And again, I forgot to tell you, there's two spheres of light. Okay, and well, definitely magnetic field lines are a figment of Faraday's imagination, and had no mathematical basis. He was a blacksmith's son. He couldn't do maths to save himself. And when he died, he asked Maxwell, who developed, looked into the problem, developed Maxwell's equations of light, mathematical stuff, which led to special relativity in modern physics. So it's interesting there. But we still teach Faraday's misguided picture. And it's, again, all stemmed in, tied into to publishing. Now, another misfit was a northerner in Cambridge, and you have to understand that Cambridge, they had no idea of teaching English literature and English, because why would you want to? I think Oxford didn't teach English literature to 1900 in Cambridge, 1911. And again, I've read a book. It's in my brain. My brain's slowly come back on, so you should check it. And don't worry, mate, I'll check all of your stuff, line by line. Or maybe, if I can't remember. And the reason that is because the way English literature was described was, oh, well, religion does it better. The Church of England does it better. So it was only when, was it London City University, whatever it is, University of London was eating their lunch that they decided to relent on it. So you've got to really understand, when you're reconstructing, it's careful to, you don't reconstruct our moralistic view. These are still people working back in. And Reverend Wilwar, northern academic, there's sort of like that's a contradiction in terms as far as the Church of England is involved. And you have to understand that the science was reserved for people in the Church of England, and who you discovered? Reverend. Bolton. The name's gone from my head. I was not in the Church of England, so was going to come over. He was going to take Charles Darwin's place, but couldn't. Priestley, that's his name. So you can imagine. So that's my poor brain sort of doing that. Now, he was the wrong side of Church of England, and did these fantastic experiments. I won't go into them. But it's only recently I read that he had to fly to, flee to America because the townsfolk were about to kill him. Several people died in public unrest because of him. So there's a lot more going into that story. But Barry was just loved by Victorian England. And Wewall was this person who's a friend of various poets. And I can't remember the name of the poet. Bloody hell. Just can't come to me. Well, come to me eventually. He's a very famous English poet. And he quipped, sort of,
we've got the name for poets and philosophers. You don't have a name for what your chappie does. And he came up with the German time thing, which is like one of those words which are too long for the English page. You know, always would be hyphenated a worker. And so he invented it in an anonymous review of a woman's book. So it's all tracking the women is quite interesting to go through it. It's sort of like the women who weren't the chief scientists play the modern role. Back then, the modern role of the, the linking people. It's very interesting to look. But he invented the word scientist and then imbued with the idea of scientist all these Victorian ideals of chivalry, which was reflected back to the Arthurian legend. So this is why scientists can't lie. It's all things that scientists can't do, and there's the thing of the evil scientist, all that, that aspect. And he invented the word scientist to describe Faraday, and they invented science education so that we could produce all Faradays. And this is in the 1836 Clarendon Report. I don't know. There's a whole series of things. But they've got the printing press and publishing being key to it. I know reading your story is there. Now, I think there's a sort of a similar thing nowadays, but it's to do with the internet and websites. I haven't really got it together. And of course, I'm just cycling here to take up time. So that is really going into. It's like it's not that. Say just one fact, like Winston Churchill and Savonarola being science fiction. It's not just a simple yes or no. It's no, technically, but then it covers so many other things. It's got these other implications to it, and it means his propensity to absorb science to go on. Now, the key thing, the key lack of understanding is the, this is not a criticism, but lack of understanding is that the science communicators they are something like all people. They really don't understand what they're talking about, and sort of echo chambers of misconceptions, and we'll put things together, and eventually, if you pack enough in and you try and harvest off this rotten harvest, you're going to come up with ideas which don't make muster. Now, one of them is Rutherford's scattering experiment. Now, Rutherford, a Kiwi up in Manchester. Manchester had Northern Mill money still rolling about, and they had the money to set someone up, a new person in the block up. And Rutherford had been down at a dinner party with the Curies, and they showed this glowing thing from the pocket, which was giving the Curie a burn, a radiation burn, and they began to investigate him. And what he'd do is he'd fire the alpha particles from the source at a, was it Geiger and Myers? I can't remember who were so involved, dark adapting and counting real times with your eyes, little phosphorescences at an angle. And, by a series of things. You get a pure beam in a vacuum, and a gas, you get a diffused beam, and by looking at the haziness of, like, looking through a slightly breathy mirror, you can see the outshape, you can see the particles are by the breath. So he was very much fitting the distribution, high statistics distribution, really close, about a fraction of a degree off from the point, and by analysing that, proved that in the centre you have of an atom, it's mostly, well, it's a thousandth the size of the radius, and a billionth of the volume, that's a thousand times a thousand times a thousand of the atom as a whole. And what is, and occasionally the atom, so most of the time it would miss, and occasionally it would hit the target and bounce back. It's got really nothing to do with quantum tunneling at all. It's got nothing to do with quantum tunneling. It's to do with the very small size. And that's a clear error, but it's sort of understandable to get that from the complete amount of rot that people came up with. And their whole distribution was mapped near and far to give the idea that all the positive charge was in the centre. Now, Rutherford never assumed that the atom was empty space, and indeed, as quantum mechanics goes, a completely different way of what it says is that the nucleus and the electron have got different quantum numbers and they don't interact, and so the nucleus can travel right through the electron without any effect. And in fact, the average position for, say, a hydrogen electron, the average central position of it is in the centre of the nucleus. And essentially, there's again a literature story which I can tell you, which will help you understand what's going on. So there was this understanding of overlapping wave functions, and you have the Copenhagen school and the Born approximation, which says that the electrons are really small and can come in and out of existence and move from one point to the other point in space faster than the speed of light and reappear. And that contradicts us, but there's a sort of mystical veil of lack of comprehension, which is totally unnecessary. But it's really interesting because it's based on a theory by St. Thomas Aquinas of angel time. Yeah, it's beautiful. Yeah, look, and was it Giles of Rome came up with... Look, there's just so much publishing literature, including the Donation of Constantine, which is a fraud, going across it. So this is a publication comes across... very important. I may as well just talk about publications here. But here's a publication story for it. So, and you have to check this up. So I've read it from one source, and, you know, as you are someone who's publishing, I'm just someone reading, and if someone tells me a bit of palaver, take it on board, check it out. Might be right, might be wrong, I might be right, but wrong, it doesn't really matter. But, so Born was publishing a book, and he said, look, I'm under pressure, I can't give you the other chapters. Schrodinger, can you give me a chapter and I'll publish it? And so he published with Bohr, Schrodinger writing a chapter. Now, Schrodinger's an interesting chap because he had three wives. So I can't remember. Really have to remember. Oh, yes. Oh, God, I forget that. I think Schrodinger came up with the idea of an aperiodic crystal determining life. So he predicted DNA in 1948, pretty amazing chappy to get through. And you can see it's a rational thought. And so Born had this St. Thomas Aquinas angel time, which so this is an amazing new scientist everywhere is talking about this really medieval view of the atom. And Sir Bourne had this probability envelope stuff, and which sort of misses the whole point of quantum mechanics and how things can be, and it's just complete palaver, mate. Complete rubbish. And then he published it in a book with Schrodinger's name, edited by Bourne. So he has a publisher, pick this up. And Schrodinger says was horrified by it, and said, look, I fundamentally disagree. You know, what you've done is horrible. And it has been perhaps the worst fraud perpetrated on the human race since probably the donation of Constantine. This is from a quantum physicist's viewpoint. It's not that you've got a problem of debate. You're debating someone. It's like debating. People have been taught a religious view of the atom. And you even read, Stephen Hawking. He says the atom's mostly empty space. It's just clearly not. And there's a simple guide to quantum physics going through. Now, this is quantum physics is important because of degeneracy and stuff like that. And I'm going, just have to keep on going. I'm just working really slowly on this bike ride. I'm just trying to think. I'm a little bit behind. Let's talk about the sun for a moment. Now, I suppose the most important thing to say is that we know the Big Bang was the first big sun, because inside the Big Bang, for the first 11 to 13 minutes afterwards, there was solar fusion going on, and hydrogen was burning up to helium. And if we have 7 protons, right, and there's 4 protons / neutrons in the helium, what had happened is that of those 7, 4 had gone into helium, and there was only 3 left. So the fuel gauge of matter went to halfway to helium. Now, people say, look, helium's only 25% of the universe. That's right, but that 25% has 4 times mass per unit than the rest, going across. And so we've got there. So all suns start off with that percentage. It may be 23%, I can't remember. 23.4, I don't know. So often these numbers come to my head. Sometimes I run down and they're correct. One time I wrote pi out to 15 decimal places and I had never memorized it. I said, what's going on there, mate? That's pretty interesting. And just a aside in that Richard Feynman was able to get all the safe combinations because scientists at Los Alamos would use the well-known numbers E and pi, stuff like that. So your thermonuclear reaction starts in the sun, and it's a 4P to 1 helium one, very slow reaction, and it's been to go up with the CNO cycle, sort of a contamination fuel burn rate ones. Now, the important thing is that the helium of the sun falls inward, so it's sort of like the exhaust chap. You're in the car, and there's no exhaust. No, it's past stuff because all the helium's on the inside. And so eventually the helium core of the sun will increase and increase. Now, I may as well tell you a beautiful solar experiment you can do yourself. So what you do is you get a test tube. You get a test tube, a match, and some water and some salt. So you put the salt in, and pack the salt in, and you can make the salt dissolve, but just pour that in, and then you slowly add in water to the edge, so you get a salt gradient. what happens is that it's high density on the inside, the bottom, and low density at the top. If you stick a match to it, it will boil instantly, and you will feel your tube vibrate. Because you've got a density gradient, and there's no convention. The heat stays in the inside. And that's what's happening with the sun. So, when plasma reaches a certain pressure, it no longer has the higher temperature leads to higher volume, leads to lower density, leads to convection. So there's a convection-free part of the sun. Now, oh, gee, I'm so painful. Oh, God, I've got to keep on going. Oh, so, it's just uncomfortable. All suns are sort of, they've got amazing onion. So, very small suns are all convection, and they're wild childs. And so, your small suns like Proxima Centauri are just spinning things around because they've got nothing stable. It's sort of like a child with no stable inner personality. Now, as they get back here to our sun, they have the convective zone, the bubbling zone, like your pot. But underneath it, it's just a hot plate. And that's because the density is across. But as you go to even higher pressure, convection starts up again. And so you have, in really big stars, you've got convection on the inside. And different things, you can have complete convection. And you have stars which are, you know, convection in the core, and they churn, and these are horizontal sequence giants. There you go. I've got no, I'm just recalling this straight off the memory bank with no interpretation. And these stars churn. And what happens is they churn and they take the inner side of their stuff out, and you can basically read off the core, what's in the core from the surface, because it gets convected up. And now these stars have such a huge neutron flux. They have a slow neutron flux. That is, they'll make an element, and that element will only last 1,000 years, then disappear. It will miss the train for the next one. So you've got slow sequence stars, and then you've got rapid neutron, the amount of neutrons going through. Now, a neutron, you have to understand, is a quantum mechanical beastie. So if I was to give you a neutron and pop it in your hand, God, oh, so if I'm gonna pop a neutron in your hand, it would drop straight through your hand, because it's a quantum mechanical thing. A nuclear reactor, I have a, look, you can imagine a, you have a vegetable garden, right? And you have, I want to have a vegetable garden because you know that it's solid between plants. You dig down in and you put something, you put your piece of radioactive stuff, the neutrons will travel right through the soil. It's not because they are not being absorbed, they're energetic, they're really slow. The best ones are really slow. And the reason is, when they're slow, they grow in size. This is why you want a moderator to grow the size of your neutron. Bloody hell, isn't it so amazing to see? And so when you slow a neutron down, it grows in size, and it's easier to do it. So it's like you're trying to hit a target with a much bigger bullet. And so this happens, and the neutron, if I put a neutron in your hand, it would flow, drop right through you, right drop through your lap, through the floor. In a skyscraper, it will go right down to the ground floor and keep on going down. It will pick up speed, much as if you dropped a brick. You know, it will pick up speed as you keep going down. Consequently, also, a neutron source, slow neutrons, go up into the air and come down and go, whoop, like that. Pretty amazing, amazing stuff. Our sun's like this. And so, the center of our sun is solid. That is, it is solid as, I don't know, a slushy solid, which spin doesn't move. That is, if I put a marker on there, that marker might drift apart. Oh, gee, I'm in pain. Okay, got to keep on going. So the centre, and that solid stuff rotates at a certain rate, and the convective layer, which is the top 25% of the sun, or 20% of the sun, is bubbling away. And what happens is that, so if it doesn't move, right, it doesn't have charges in it, it's not conducting any electricity. There is maybe some magnetic field in it, we don't know. It's not a plasma as we know it. It's much more like a snowball, but obviously a fireball. And, so the tachosphere has this drag. Now, what's happening is that the equator, the wind is blowing faster than the tachosphere. And then there's a point where it's not doing anything, it's the same speed. And the further above to the poles, it's going more slowly. So the sphere's acting as a domino, which creates a magnetic field. And the magnetic field interacts, and this is, again, a fundamental misunderstanding of magnetic field lines. But this creates some sort of vibration which couples above the chromosphere. So this is the chromosphere that you can see. The gas density goes up. And at the surface is the actual cooler part of the sun, and then the temperature really goes up, as you know. Now, when this process dies, so that we're looking at a peeled sun. The redness has been peeled off and it's peeled down. If we peel it any further, it will get smaller and hotter, less power, because it will be smaller. So it goes down. So we're looking at a peeled sun. It's been peeled by its own microwave engine. Now, they believe it's a microwave engine. So I've read a few papers of it. This is coupling energy out to this area and creating microwave heated plasma. The plasma is getting heated. There's a whole series of stories. Oh. And resolve this for different speeds. Your solar winds at different speeds. I can't remember if they're going slower from the poles or the equator. But if you've got two flows at different speeds and they're rotating, you get shock waves. Now, that means that the solar wind develops a solar shock wave, sort of a spiral shock wave, outside the Earth's orbit. You know, before the two speeds get up to each other. So the fast speed hits a slow speed stuff and builds up. So it's still going fast, but it slows down a little bit. And so it's going a little bit slower than the stuff coming behind it. So it's a traffic jam. So you have this... your sun has the solar wind coming out, the gas burning up, and it really is the cooking away the cloud layer, which would cover the sun. So we're sort of seeing, sort of like we're looking at the Earth, it's all this cloud layer. Well, what if we could burn those clouds away? We could see deep down. So we're seeing through a clear atmosphere. And so the sun's atmosphere stretches way out to beyond the orbit, the heliosphere. So our sun, technically, in terms of its influence on space, in terms of real estate, so historically it's that big. It's 1.395 million kilometres across. Is that right? Yeah. No, million metres. I have to get this into my head. I'll have to go back. It's 150 million kilometres away, and it's 1.3 1.4 million kilometres across, and we're, oh, this is another, yeah, go figure thing, where we are, our radius is 4 pi, thousand kilometres, and how does this come? Well, they defined the radius of the circumference of the Earth to be 10 millimetres from the equator, 10,000 kilometres or 10 millimetres from the equator to the North Pole through Paris. And so, put this through. Now, it just so happens that the square root of 10 is approximately pi, so you get all these pi keeps on appearing throughout, just because the square root of 10 is 10 is about pi. So you've got this structure of the sun. Now, and the different things, and we've got the CNO cycle in the centre of our star, which is slowly picking up and heating up. So that's getting across there. And there's obviously into it a whole lot of quantum mechanics describing how the fusion reaction occurs. And I see what I'm doing in terms of, oh yeah. So I'll just keep on going for a while. So, you can imagine my intense reading of it and how, having understood this, and I haven't really understood it in terms of, I've got anyone, got friends to tell or anyone who's interested, sort of just bit by bit, how does it go together? You know, what are these shock waves? Because the solar wind comes in them. So for us, it's a gentle breeze, but after it, there's a gust coming forward. And so it's a very interesting thing. Now, the other literature thing I want to cover is Bruno Giovanni, or whatever his name Bruno is, who got torched in 1599 or 1600. Dominican friar, autistic savant, memory man, picking up all these different bits of information. But you pick up some really important things, that there isn't just one Inquisition, there were about 12 grades of Inquisitions. The worst one were the political ones, where you have a link to a political belief system. Like the Spanish Inquisition was worse, whereas the Roman Inquisition was much more sort of like the censorship office nowadays. I don't know. It's sort of, we have counter-terrorism this time of the year, though. Believe it, they had a sort of a belief system for it in terms of counter-terrorism. And the interesting thing is that they stopped Bruno outside a city. Could have been Milan, I can't remember. He's always been kicked off because he's sold people too quickly. He's a lovely man to read. But the important thing is that he used to write footnotes, margin notes in his books. And you read into it. Back that time, the Inquisition operated on getting people's books and looking for the margin notes, and then inquiring about what does this margin note mean in this margin. And these people back then would say, wouldn't have the gumption to say, oh, look, I write stupid things in my margins. I don't believe any of it. I just write it in jest. They didn't know how to say that. So it was all tucked up, and it was hooked up by the Inquisition, and kicked on his way. But you follow him up through Europe, and he plugs into a school of Greek thought, which is Epicurus, and the motion of many worlds, and worlds and stars and planets, and I can't say it's your belief that Kepler, that was it Galileo threw out Kepler because his orbits were elliptical, fits in totally with the entire Galileo story. It's just so beautiful. I don't know, you should also read about Galileo and the Roof of the World and Dante, which is a published poet, and how people, once it's gotten in the written world, how could you contradict it? And so it's sort of nowadays a version of writing is actually pouring concrete. Like we're predicting to the airport in Sydney, they're pouring concrete and everyone's lightning down. That's a version. But the important thing here is that it was John Diggs, a British person, astronomer, Elizabethan astronomer, and they had the supernova which went off, which was the touchstone for Tycho Brahe to go into the mad, dangerous quarter. And, all this idea that your starry firmament, the starry blanket, was actually three-dimensional, coming into the idea. They didn't know how three-dimensional it was possibly going to be. And Bruno and Shakespeare probably didn't meet, but they had dinner at John Diggs. And you also have to remember that there were not institutions in the internet, so there's a lot more social people having dinner together and meeting coffee shops and all this stuff. And the records from Bruno say that John Diggs had the pictures of these two vanished astronomers. I don't know if you know where it goes. So Shakespeare saw these two Danish astronomers, got the basic story of the mad Danes in a castle, and there you have Hamlet. So it's well established that Shakespeare, Hamlet is writing about Tycho Brahe, Brahe, whatever it is, to go across. And again, fascinating to hear from your book that it fits in with my general research. Look, I'm not an academic, I'm just sort of a forensic person going in and to sort of see Galileo and there's a whole series of things. There's a lot of interpretation of Galileo, what the church said, revolves apparently around the interpretation of a comma or semicolon in what the church says. And indeed, if you read into Galileo and the church stuff, the church seems a lot more rational. They were saying, given the resolution of your telescope, you're saying the stars are this big, therefore at distance they'll be. They were using scientific arguments, a real scientific thing. It wasn't anything close to what was going on. And Galileo was a friend going blind and all that whole crap. So, I don't know. So it was really interesting to hear that the Puritans, the people who really objected to all the new stuff was the Protestant people. And sort of that's, I was trying to understand now. This has been going for a while. We'll call it a day going on this exercise bike and send this off to you. And I should point out there's no expectation that you'll listen to it. It's just a way of getting the notes out. And when I do write to you, eventually this will come together. So I hope you are impressed that people are reading your books, taking it, and your general academic who's going to tell you rubbish. Okay, some people have obviously told you rubbish. They're not going to be the people who go through and read it line by line and have a conversation with you. They're more interested in having a photo shoot and picking up the next page. Okay, thanks a lot for listening. Thank you.
podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.